So, Ann Aptaker, we're going to talk a lot today about Cantor Gold, who is the protagonist in your Cantor Gold series. And one thing about Cantor is she's good at solving murder mysteries, but she is also an art thief and a bit of a scoundrel. Now, would you agree that she is a scoundrel?
Oh, yes, indeed. She is a scoundrel. She can also be a cad from time to time. But she is a criminal. As you say, she's an art thief and a smuggler. And for people who have read the series, they'll know why. But for people who haven't, I'll tell them. She's an art thief and a smuggler, a criminal, because the books take place in the 1950s. And, of course, at that time, it was illegal to lead a gay life. So she figures if the law is going to treat her as a criminal, essentially just for being alive or who she takes to bed, for her, you know, her personal life, that she doesn't owe the law any allegiance whatsoever. So she says to herself, hey, you're going to treat me as a criminal? I'll show you criminal. And she becomes, instead of a legitimate art dealer, she becomes an art thief and a smuggler, but a very dapper one. She's very well dressed.
So she's a scoundrel and a cad with a good excuse. And I got to tell you, I love scoundrels. They're so fun when they're likable, and she is definitely likable. So this is going to be fun. So let's get right to talking about her and maybe even about you right after this.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shree.
Earlier, I was talking to Ann Aptaker, and she is my guest today. She writes the Cantor Gold crime mystery series and has been the recipient of Lambda Literary and multiple Goldie Awards. Plus, she's had some short stories and novellas, I guess I should say, and even some flash fiction published. So 2 years ago, you were on episode 39, and we discussed Flesh and Gold.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And since then, you've had two books that have been published before the current book that we're going to talk about today, which is book number 6, Hunting Gold.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, Hunting Gold is an aptly named title for this book.
Well, it's true. She's being hunted.
Yes. And it's a fun ride. One thing I want to tell people, though, is when this show airs, it is going to be on Tuesday, July 5th. Anne's book, Hunting Gold, releases on July 12th, which is exactly 1 week from today, if you're listening on the day this releases, which means you have no excuse. Pre-order it right after this show, and you'll be glad you did. Trust me, you will be glad you did.
Well, thank you, Brad.
And we'll certainly appreciate if you get the pre-order in.
Oh, indeed.
And normally I do a bit of a chit-chat before we get into the story, but I really like Cantor, and so I'm going to get right to her.
Okay.
As we said, Cantor is kind of a scoundrel and a cad, so she definitely falls under the definition to me of an anti-hero.
Yes.
Why did you choose to have her be an anti-hero?
Well, a little backstory. Originally, I had thought of her as being a private investigator, but coincidentally, even though I've been in the art game for a long time as a curator, I also worked for a short time for a private investigator writing their investigative reports. So I got to see the criminal justice system up close and personal. And I realized that the only way for my lead character, for Cantor, as a gay woman, as a lesbian in the 1950s, the only way for her to keep her integrity and her independence in a society that hates her and that labels her a criminal, the only way that she could keep her integrity was by being a criminal, was by being someone who lived outside the law, specifically living outside the law that condemns her. So she evolved from being on one side of the law to being on the other side of the law. And she's thrived ever since. She really belongs there because the law is no friend of hers, as it was no friend.
And she lives pretty well because of it.
She lives very well, which gives her the last laugh, because in American society, we know that money talks. And she earns fistfuls of money. And the money protects her to some extent. I mean, being a thief and being an out gay lesbian, she refuses to live in the closet. So, which, of course, in that time, in those days, to be leading a gay life publicly was, I mean, my God, you could be swept up and arrested at the drop of a hat. But the money protects her because she can afford an excellent lawyer and so on. We know that money protects people. And insofar as the money can protect her, she's a little more protected than the average person. But she still can be arrested and confined to prison or worse, the psycho ward, which is where they used to put gay people, if not in jail. So she has sort of the best of both worlds in a way. She has the money to protect herself and also to live quite well and to buy a new car whenever she feels like it and to have her suits custom tailored and all of that and live in a splendid apartment. But she walks a very fine line. She could be arrested at any moment.
Something I'm curious about, because you brought it up, it's very well known that back in that period and before, it wasn't uncommon for gay men to be castrated. What about women? Was sterilization something that occurred at that time? Do you know?
Not that I'm aware of specifically for lesbianism. Truthfully, what happened to a lot of women, as far as sterilization, more often than not, happened to women of color. And it didn't necessarily, not surprising at all. And it didn't necessarily have to do with their lesbianism. It may not have had to do with lesbians at all, but just another form of punishment. If a woman of color was arrested for perhaps prostitution or even something not related to sex, for having an abortion, for instance, which was then illegal, and unfortunately we may be facing that again. So from what I understand, unfortunately, when women's sterilization happened, it was more often performed horrifically on women of color. Now, that's not to say it wasn't performed on other women as well, as specifically lesbians, but I don't know the statistics on that. But I do believe that the majority of them, those kinds of sexual procedures of sterilization, were performed on women of color.
Yeah, I don't know if many people are aware of it, and I bring this up because I'm a huge supporter of Planned Parenthood, but the right likes to point out that the founder of Planned Parenthood, and I can't remember her name, she was part of a eugenics movement.
Yes, she was.
That started in, I guess, the mid-1800s, mm-hmm. where the elite felt like abortion will reduce the less, for lack of a better word, the lesser than in the society.
Yeah, this is unfortunate.
And that is why, part of why she started Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, this is true.
So it doesn't surprise me that given the economic status and that sort of thing of Black people during that time period, and that they would be the ones that would be singled out.
Yeah, so. And I think that was true right up through the 1950s and possibly into the 60s. Though a greater scholar than I would have to, you know, affirm those kinds of statistics, but it would not be surprising.
So back to her being an anti-hero, what do you think it is about anti-heroes that people love? I'm going to give a really extreme example, Deadpool.
Mm-hmm.
He's about as big of an anti-hero as you can get, and he's popular. What do you think it is about them that people like?
Well, I think it's really very simple. For the same reason we still all love Billy the Kid, we love people who get away with things that the rest of us can't get away with. I think we all know that the law and the bureaucracies in life are really a pain in the ass, and they really hold us all under the boot, sometimes just a matter of inconvenience, like waiting online for, you know, 8 hours at the DMV, all the way to a more serious oppression of jailing people for things they didn't do or because they're the wrong skin color or the wrong sex or what have you. But I think we're all aware that the bureaucracy really has us under the thumb. Anti-heroes refuse to put up with that. They get around it. Sometimes they get under it, sometimes they get over it, but they always just kick it in the teeth. And we like that. You know, it's a relief to know that somebody can get away with things and kick the society, kick the law in the teeth, that the rest of us don't have either the talent or the courage to do.
I think a good example of that is Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, for sure,
During their time period, they were very popular amongst the general public.
Bonnie and Clyde and John Dillinger, and of course, my favorite, who I just mentioned, Billy the Kid. I mean, he's a legend.
Yeah, I mean, times were tough, and if somebody stuck it to the big guy, yep. Hey, go for it.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is the this is the tradition that my hero, that Cantor Gold, comes out of, is that because she's treated as a criminal just for breathing, she adopts that same position of, I'll show you what criminal is, and the hell with you. And she does it.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. It's easy by clicking Love the Podcast in the show notes. If you prefer another app, you can click the same link to see if they offer them. Who knows? Brad may just read yours on the air.
Now, that laissez-faire attitude about I'm a lesbian and this is the 1950s and just deal with it, how prevalent, I'm sure there were women at that time that did have that. Are you aware of any that did, or how difficult was it to do that? Because Cantor seems to get away with it pretty well.
Well, she gets away with it because she is a criminal. She knows how to get away with things. If she didn't know how to get away with things, she would have been arrested a long time ago, if not for her sexuality, for her thievery. She knows how to get away with crime, so to speak. Now, whether there were other women at the time, there were a number of butch lesbians. Always, I mean, you can find examples of them, you know, all through history.
Yeah.
But whether they were also criminals is another matter, although there's been some very interesting books written and research done on female pirates, particularly of the 17th and 18th century, how some of them might have also been lesbian women. But as far as going back to the 50s, there were a great many clubs, bars, lesbian bars, where you had this very butch-femme dynamic. So there were lots of butch women running around. But whether they did so publicly, to the extent that Cantor does, most didn't because it was just too dangerous. But some did. You know, some did.
Yeah, and I would say especially in New York.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's probably a little easier. I was in an interview recently, and I'm working on a series. I'm still working with Mitch, but I'm working on a series that starts in 1920. And I'm trying to get research on that. And because L.A., believe it or not, was a very conservative community at that time, especially Hollywood, they were not happy with these movie studios moving in and bringing all these decadent individuals into the city.
Right.
Because of that, there's very little information about gay life during that time period. I know where gay men hung out and picked each other up. But beyond that, there was an area called The Run where, quote, air quotes I'm doing, gay bars and lesbian bars existed. Of course, they didn't have that on the sign, but I can't for the life of me find out where they were. I just knew they were there, and it was called The Run. I would guess in New York City, it's a little easier for you.
It was, yeah.
Because
yeah.
There was a period where it was kind of in.
That's true,
to have
but New York
gay friends.
Also had a very oppressive law. I believe it was called the Mask Law, but I think it also had another name. But in any event, what it was, you had to wear only the clothing of your birth gender.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't hide your gender with clothing or a mask, which is where the term the Mask Law came in. And if you were found to be wearing the wrong clothes, you could be arrested. So what people used to do, people who did cross-dress, men or women, they would make sure they were wearing at least one article of clothing of their birth gender, and it could be underwear.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a law in New York, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, in some ways it was easier just because the society was easier. But then there was this law.
Yeah, and in fact, I read the history of Stonewall, the actual bar itself, not just the incident, but what led up to the riot. And I'm sorry, I don't mind calling it a riot. It was justifiable. And that went right up to that period.
Right.
That whole, you know, you had to have something on you
right.
that was feminine or something on you that was masculine.
Right. It wasn't all that long ago.
Otherwise, right. yeah, it was not that long
right.
ago. It's, we tend to, I think we're forgetting that too quickly.
Yeah.
I think that's human nature, but especially kids growing up today, I don't think they realize what.
Well, that's true. I don't think they realized what we went through. Unfortunately, they may be realizing it again through personal experience if the current political climate is successful in bringing back anti-gay laws. I hope not, for all of our sakes, and particularly for the young people. Why should they have, you know, everything we fought for so that they could be free? But I think all of us in the LGBTQ plus community, irrespective of our age, whether we were young or old, need to be really vigilant right now because they're coming for us again.
Yes, they are. And I hate to be negative, but it's also positive. I do think it's going to get worse before it gets better, but I am optimistic about the future. And one of the reasons, I'm going to equate this to Russia right now. With the war going on in Ukraine, what they found is the older generation that is getting all their information from the Russian propaganda television have been supporting the war. That is waving now that more dead bodies are coming into the country. But as a rule, they are supportive. What they say is the younger generation that has heard the story, you know, they had McDonald's and all these other things. And they've heard the story about the way Russia used to be. And they are rebelling, not, you know, in the streets or such, but they are really against what's happening because they don't want to what they heard it used to be like to happen to them. So I have optimism that even though things are really looking bad these days, especially our trans friends, which is just horrendous what is happening to them. It's the pendulum. And I really hope because they're pushing things so far, they're going to not know what hits them when it springs back.
I heard
those kids stand up.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I think in the long run, you're probably right. But the short run could be dicey, could be difficult. But, you know, we'll see.
It could be dicey and it could be deadly.
Yeah. Oh, boy, it could very much be deadly. Yeah.
Well, it already is, actually, yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. And for my character, you know, for Cantor, she, at the time that she was active, you know, in the 1940s and 50s, the books take place, the first book is 1949, and then the series goes through the 1950s. She is, you know, very much an out butch dyke. Whether she would be considered today trans is an open question. People have asked me that. And I can't really answer that because at the time that she existed, that really wasn't much of a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few experimental transition surgeries and so on, but it wasn't really under any serious consideration. So when people ask me if she's trans, I say I can't really answer that because of the time that she's living in. Now, if she were here now, I don't know that she would be trans. It's quite possible, but she could also just be a butch lesbian, and there's nothing wrong with being a butch lesbian. They're some of the most interesting and glamorous people on earth, as far as I'm concerned.
Before I came out, I lived in Las Vegas, and I used to go to the Gay and Lesbian Center, which I think I've said before, it was almost a shack back then, because it was quite a few years ago. And now they have this incredible facility, which is wonderful. But I went to this gay men's meeting, and there were a whole lot of men there that were in their mid-70s up into their 90s. And they all waited till their wives died before they came out. And I asked many of them, if you had to do it over again, would you do it differently? And every single one of them gave me the same response. And that response was, that is impossible for me to say.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible. I don't have an answer for that because of the situation. So...
And I'm sure, and you know, some of them probably have children whom they love dearly.
Yes.
So you would be asking them, would they have given up the chance to be a parent? And who can answer that, you know?
Well, I'm one of those. You know, I have a daughter. She's 24 years old. I love her to death.
Of course.
She was 2 years old when I came out. So do I wish I came out earlier? I think of things that, boy, I could have had a great time. And then I have to think about, but I wouldn't have my daughter.
Right, exactly.
So it really is one of those impossible things
right,
to say.
Of course. Yeah.
And she's just fabulous. So naturally, she's my kid. What can I say?
Which makes her fabulous.
Exactly. So we've established Cantor is, I don't know if nefarious is the right word, because that tends to be a little more criminal. But what I want to know is, we meet Cantor in 1949. And how old is she at that time?
She would, in 1949, I sort of imagine her in her mid to late 30s. So that by the time you get to the current book, to Hunting Gold, she would be in her early-ish 40s, around in there. She's a grown-up.
Yeah, and most of the books are in the 50s.
Most of the books,
one
yeah.
Is 19-
and the first one.
And I'm sorry, I forget the name of the... Is it Criminal Gold?
Criminal Gold, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Criminal Gold was in 1949.
Right.
So what I'm curious about is, what made Cantor who she is today? What was her life like before 1949?
Well, she grew up in Coney Island, which I realized when I was formulating her in my mind was the only place where she could grow up so that she and have the chutzpah that she needs to get through life in the way that she gets through life. Growing up in Coney Island, she learned how to beat the suckers at their own game. So that's where she grew up, and that's what taught her how to beat the system, because she grew up among the carny hucksters and all of that that you find in Coney Island. It also is, she grew up at the time when the old line gangsters, what they used to call the old mustache Petes and all, the old line gangsters were being pushed aside by the more streamlined, modern, organized crime. And that's where she meets, when she was a kid, she meets a man who was taking over the Coney Island rackets in this new streamlined, organized crime way. And he is a recurring, now that she's all grown up, he is a recurring character in all the books. He is Sig L'Oreal, and he eventually rose to be the king of the city in the rackets. He is the big boss of New York City crime and beyond New York City. I mean, he is the top of the heap in what became, as we understand it, very sophisticated, organized crime, the mob. And of course, the 40s and 50s were the heyday of organized crime, of the mob, and he's the top of the heap. So he didn't exactly mentor her, but she, as a child, literally a child of like 9 and 10, she watched him. She was aware of him taking over the rackets in Coney Island, of pushing aside the old line gangsters, the street gangs. And she learned from him how to really do it, how to really live life as a criminal in the classiest and strongest possible way. So that's what her life was like before 1949. And then another woman who also is a recurring character in the book, who actually did mentor her, and she is Mom Sheinbaum, Esther Mom Sheinbaum. Mm-hmm. And she,
and don't mess with her.
Don't mess with Mom. She is based on a real person, Frederica Marm Mandelbaum, who was a very successful, or actually the most successful fence purveyor of stolen goods in the history of New York City crime. But she was in the late 19th century. So Mom Sheinbaum is based on her. And she fenced, when Cantor was a kid in Coney Island, her earliest forays into crime, where she would go to the beach as a kid, like 8 or 9, 10 years old, and things, she wouldn't really pick people's pockets or bags, but you're at the beach, things fall out of your bathing suit pocket or your beach bag or whatnot, and she would scoop them up, and she wouldn't give them back. And some of these things were fairly valuable, people's jewelry, a woman takes off her earrings, to go swimming and whatnot, some guy's watch. And she able to hook up with Mom Sheinbaum, who taught her the difference between the good stuff and the bad, and the junk. And Mom really was Cantor's mentor. Now, when Cantor grew up and realized her sexuality and, you know, started dating women and all that sort of thing, it didn't seem to bother Mom at all. But we do learn in the first book that this really did bother Mom, that she really thinks of Cantor as perverse. They have a very interesting relationship. The three of them, Cantor and Sig L'Oreal and Mom Sheinbaum, because they all have this history going all the way back to Cantor's childhood, it is this, they form a kind of criminal family unit that is like a seesaw. Sometimes Mom, you get the feeling that Mom really does care about Cantor, and sometimes you get the feeling that she would sell her down the river and, you know, in a heartbeat. So it's this emotion, but between the three of them, and the same way with Sig, you get that same feeling. Between the three of them, it's this emotional seesaw that I find really interesting to write.
Okay, now you mentioned Sig L'Oreal. Before Sig, there was a big crime boss in the city, and his name was Dominic Angeli.
Okay.
And am I correct that he was the big wig in the city at that time?
Yeah, in Hunting Gold, right, right. He was the big boss before Sig. Sig took over from Dominic Angeli. Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The reason I ask is, I found it interesting what you said about Dominic, and that is, he was a mob boss who stayed under the radar. I was going to say under the rainbow, but maybe it's because it's Pride Month that I said that. But anyway, he's a mob boss who stayed under the radar. He didn't flash his money, didn't go to all the fine dining restaurants, didn't get the good theater's tickets at the shows. And what I find interesting is, many years ago, I heard an interview with a guy that's a wise guy. And wise guy sometimes is referred to as somebody involved in a crime syndicate, but it's also referred to somebody in law enforcement who gets into the crime element and acts a part of it, so eventually they can crack down. And that's what this guy was. And when he was being interviewed, he said the public has this perception of mobsters being like Al Pacino in Scarface, living in these luxury mansions. And he said the reality is they don't live like that at all. They're really nothing more than trashy thugs who happen to have a lot of money. Given that, and this may not be a question you can answer. It's probably more of a philosophical question. But given that they have all this money and they're always worried about maybe being killed and they don't really live that luxuriously, why do they do it?
Oh, boy. I'm not a law enforcement, or a legal scholar. For some, it's cultural, as the mafia was for so long.
I always wonder if it's just a power thing.
Yes, it could very well be a power thing. People who feel they're powerless will often seek power in destructive ways. I don't think there's any one reason why somebody becomes a criminal. It's an extremely complex story. I think the better question is why, which is what you talked about earlier, why do we like criminals? Why was a film like The Godfather and the book, such an enormous success? Why do we love these people? Why do we love Billy the Kid? Why was John Gotti so popular? It's because they do things that the rest of us can't. Now, whether they actually live lavishly is an open question. Your friend, was up close and personal with mob guys, and they lived under the radar. On the other hand, some of our biggest criminals who are CEOs do live very lavishly, and but they operate only barely on the right side of the law, so they don't get caught always. But they're just as criminal, and they do live very, very lavishly. It depends on what you identify as crime.
Yeah, and I think that has changed. I was doing a lot of reading on some of the most dangerous gangs in the world, such as the Bloods and the Crips. And they say, it's almost like they're not gangs anymore. They're major corporations, and they're very well organized. Yeah. And so I think it is different now. But I think that was a little more true back in the past. Maybe I'm wrong. And I wasn't expecting to know the answer offhand as a psychiatrist or sociologist. I was just trying to get your opinion.
When I would research mobster life, criminal life in the 40s and 50s. The, you know, the Frank Costellos and all of the, they did live quite well. Frank Costello had a luxury apartment in Manhattan on Central Park West. I believe it was the Century. I'm not quite sure which it might have been. If not the Century, it was one of the others. Lucky Luciano had had an apartment in the Waldorf Towers. So these folks did live very well in Cantor's time. And Sig L'Oreal, who is, you know, this constant presence in her life, he has a luxury apartment in New York. And in book five, Murder and Gold, I also introduced that he has this palatial place out on Long Island. So the gangsters at that time did live very well, even though Sig also lives under the radar. He does not go to flashy places. He doesn't want, you know, his picture in the paper. The really successful ones didn't, and in the books, in my books, don't live very flashy lives, but they live very well.
And I guess an example of somebody that lives a good life, I used to live in a house in Brentwood, which is where O.J. lived. They did tear down O.J.'s house. I think the people that moved in there weren't really thrilled to live in that building. But a very upscale area. And I had the luck of renting the maid's quarters. And let's just say it was a deal of a century. But the house I lived in was Mickey Cohen's house.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And let's just say Mickey wasn't the nicest of guys, but it was a nice house. So, I guess, maybe I'm wrong entirely. Some of them did live pretty well.
Yeah. And Mickey Cohen was of that era of the 40s and 50s, absolutely. Yeah,
and the exciting thing that we like to tell people is that a bomb was put under the house.
Yeah, right.
The people that put the bomb there happened to put it directly under his safe. That's what saved his life. So I'm going off on a tangent, but I like that story, so I like to tell it.
It's a good story.
Yes, it is. So Cantor, there have been two characters that I have had a crush on in lesbian novels. One is in Anne McMahon's novel, and I can't remember the character. And the other is Cantor. And I got to say, I have a crush on Cantor.
Oh, goodness. How wonderful.
She is damn sexy.
She's very sexy.
And what was funny to me is early in the book, you describe the numerous scars on her face, describing each one in detail. And I was finding that even sexier. Now, in my head, you clearly weren't describing big gashing scars, the little scars that we get throughout life. And I was like, well, she's hot.
Yeah, she's very hot.
You know she's sexy. What is her appeal?
Well, let's talk about the scars for a minute, and then I'll get back to what is her appeal. The scars, in a way, are part of her appeal in that, yeah, they're not these big disfiguring scars. They're a cut here and a slash there on above her lip, on her cheek, the usual sorts of places. And in each book, she gets another one. And they are, they're souvenirs of her criminal life. They're the scars she's gotten when her survival's been threatened. I think what makes her sexy is that for Cantor, survival is everything. And it's not just survival to live another day, but to live life with zest another day, to live life on her own terms. She swaggers through life. And who can resist a woman in a suit who swaggers? So I think putting those things together, her attitude, her skill, her willingness to face danger, her unabashed sexuality, I think all of those things together make her a romantic figure, a sexy figure. She's hot.
She is hot, and I think you definitely nailed why.
Oh, good. I'm glad you think so.
Definitely nailed why. You were talking about the justice system earlier, and I want to bring this up. Well, actually, let's start with the beginning of the book. Because the book is a fun ride in general.
You're talking about Hunting Gold.
Yes, okay. Hunting Gold. Mm-hmm. What I liked is, and I hope you don't mind, this is right at the very beginning. It opens up, boom, we're right into the action because she is in a bar, what we would call a lesbian bar today.
Right.
And there is a raid and it is violent. And then it calms down. And then boom, we're hit with more action again. And I found that so exciting. I was like, I cannot wait to continue to read this roller coaster.
Oh, thank you.
So I love the way that you opened it up with that. The reason I'm bringing it up is because of the raid on the bar. You and I have talked in the past about the justice system, and you even mentioned it today that you've lost faith in the justice system. Having worked for a private detective for a while. Do you think it's better, worse, or the same today?
I suppose it depends on where. It's probably about the same, maybe slightly worse in a place like New York. It's probably a lot worse in Texas with what we're seeing with the anti-gay laws and the proliferation of guns. So I think it depends where. But for a lot of people, for the marginalized, for gay people, for people of color, for immigrants and so on, it was never good. And at best, it's no worse. But it always teeters on being worse. And I think that's where we are right now, generally. Even in a place like New York, it can teeter into worse. But in places, say, like Texas and Florida, it's already worse, in my opinion. People who live there might have a different feeling.
Yeah, it's funny. My husband is a Black man, and we live with his mother, recently moved in to live with her. And it very frequently comes up when somebody mentions the good old days. We have this kind of stifled chuckle.
Yeah, sure.
Like, whose good old days are we talking about? It certainly wasn't theirs.
Right. But what Cantor does, she lives at the time when, for gay people or people of color or women generally, it was not the good old days. But Cantor insists on making her days as good as they can possibly be. The dedication page to Hunting Gold says, this book is dedicated to everyone who insists on having a place in the world.
And I love that.
Thank you. And Cantor insists on that. She's probably insisted on that since she was 5, when she had a sense, when she finally, started to have a sense of herself. So I think another thing that makes Cantor sexy is that strength, that insistence on having a place in the world, so that those days that she lived in, which were not so good for women who couldn't get a credit card on their own, were barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen and all of that. And of course, for people of color, it was terrible days. But Cantor will not sit still for this. She lives every day as if she owns the day. And she does, because she won't let anyone take the day away from her, which in this book is what someone's trying to do.
Is that part of the reason why you placed her story in the 1950s?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That period of time has a real fascination for me. When you talked about, right, some people look back on that and say the good old days. Well, in some ways they were. I mean, I remember New York as a kid in the 50s and 60s as being the good old days in a way, even though I knew that they weren't. But on the surface, they were. The city was golden. There was almost full employment. The streets were safer. Broadway was hopping. And across America, the suburbs were growing. The unions were strong. So in many ways, it really was the good old days, those post-war years of great prosperity. But what makes that time so interesting for me was that right under that crust was a darkness. Don't forget, it's when the mob was at its highest, organized crime and the corruption was at its highest in the 40s and 50s, because there was this darkness right under that golden crust. When the guys came back from World War II, they had seen, especially the ones in Europe who'd seen the concentration camps and so on, they had seen some of the most awful things that human beings could do to each other. And when they came back, the society changed. On the one hand, yes, the suburbs were there and these guys had jobs and all of this, but what the story that wasn't told was how many of them were suffering what was now or then called battle fatigue. We know it now as PTSD. They came back very badly scarred. And they understood that the world and humanity could really be beastly. This was also the time, as a result of all this, you had the time, this was the introduction of film noir. People think film noir is the 30s. It wasn't. It was the post-war. It was in the 50s, the late 40s and 50s. Because there was that attitude that, yeah, things are really great on the surface, but everyone knew that just underneath was rot. So that period really interests me because it's golden on the one hand, and Cantor takes full advantage of, you know, the glory that was New York City in the 50s. But she thrives in the underworld. She thrives in it because it's the only place that she can be free. But she understands that the only reason the underworld exists is because the world itself, the golden world, is corrupt. And she knows how to play that.
And I got to say, that is one thing that I really like about her. She can go to highest end of town. You know New York way better than I do. You grew up there. All I know is rich people live on Park Avenue, which I know not everybody lives on Park Avenue. But she goes to the finest neighborhoods and mingles with the muckety-muck.
Well, she does because they're her clients. She steals art from these people.
And then she goes and she's dealing with the underworld.
Right, yeah.
And she's comfortable in both places.
She's comfortable in both places. Yeah, she deals with the, you know, the Fifth Avenue and Park Avenue crowd because they are her clients. I mean, one of the recurring characters in all the books, or most of the books, and who is definitely in Hunting Gold, is a curator, Vivian Parkhurst Trent, who is the curator of European paintings at a museum which everyone will guess is the Metropolitan Museum of Art, even though I don't name it, but it's pretty clear that's what it is. So she not only has a society background, which she does, but she also is a scholar. I mean, you know, she has one of the classiest jobs on the planet as the curator of European paintings at one of the world's foremost museums. And so Cantor mingles with Vivienne quite well. And her other, throughout the books, we meet a number of her very high-end clients whom she steals art for. But you're right. Then she, you know, goes to dive bars and has a marvelous time. She thrives in the underworld. But she can maneuver through both, absolutely. Because she doesn't think of either one of them as greater or lesser. They just all belong to her. In a way, there, you know, it's life, and life is there for the taking. Whether she's in the upper end or the lower end, it's all the same to her. It's a piece of life that she will grab onto.
Even though she is a scoundrel, if the rest of us had that kind of zest for life, the world would be a better place.
Oh, absolutely. If Cantor Gold ran the world, we'd all be better off.
Yeah. I mean, she really does have a zest for life.
Oh, absolutely.
One thing I'm curious about, and I hesitate to bring this up, but I hear this a lot from lesbians, that one of their frustrations is that you always have to have a relationship in a lesbian novel. And gay men say the same thing too sometimes. Now, I know in book 4, Flesh and Gold, Sophie, I guess, was an ex-lover of Cantor.
The love of her life, absolutely.
Yeah, and you'll have to forgive me, I did not read the book. But as far as I know, is that the only time a love interest is really brought up in the series?
Well, because the series is crime and mystery fiction, it has different parameters than a romance. In a romance book, clearly there has to be a romance, a happily ever after, and so on. In crime and mystery fiction, you don't have to have that. Cantor, though, is a very sexual being, and there's a part of her that is a romantic in the true dictionary sense of the word. She doesn't fall in love easily because the character you mentioned, Sophie, was stolen from her in a horrific way. And I'm not going to spill the beans because I want people to read the books and, you know, see why. But in any event, this love of her life was taken from her in a terrible way. As a result of that, as you read in Hunting Gold, there is this wound that she talks about, this wound that cannot heal. And that's the loss of Sophie. However, it's not that Cantor always has love interests, but she always has lust interests.
Yeah.
But they're not, I mean, she can be a cad, but she treats her women very well. So that even when she's involved with someone who it's primarily a lustful thing, there's a depth of feeling that she gives to them. It's not just slam, bam, thank you, ma'am, kind of hello and goodbye. Now, each book has an element of that because that would be true to Cantor. And these women are often central to the crime that she's investigating or involved in or trying to escape from or whatever it is she's trying to do. So it's not so much a matter of whether there's a love interest. There is always, shall we say, a female interest. Mm-hmm. Because that's Cantor's world. She's, you know, she loves women. And these women are sometimes in danger or they can be dangerous. And so it's not hard for me to bring that kind of lusty romantic element into the book without it being a romance, because in Life of Crime, she would run up against women who are either in danger or who are themselves dangerous. And so they become central to the plot. So there's no happily ever after romance kind of thing. That would never happen in the books that I write. No, I don't want to say never, but the chances are less than 1%.
Well, and I like that you said that, you know, it's a crime novel, not a romance novel. Those of you that are tired of hearing me on my soapbox, I'm not going there today. But I'm just going to loosely say some people don't get that there's a difference. And I really like what you're saying about Cantor being a very sexual woman.
Oh, very. Yeah.
Because I have no problem with anyone sleeping around. And as long as they're honest about it, you know, hey, we're just going to get it on. Don't expect much more than this in the morning.
Yeah.
Go for it. I think that's great.
Yeah.
Maybe I did that at one time in my life. I don't know. But not everybody likes that. Have you gotten any kind of blowback from that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have. Not a lot. Really, not a lot at all. But here and there, people want Cantor to fall in love, and you know, that's what they want her to do. And she may, I don't know, see how her life goes. But real crime fiction fans don't expect that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I haven't gotten a lot of blowback, but where I have gotten it, and it hasn't been much, it's really been very, very little, but where I have gotten it is from the lesbian readers who want there to be, since 99% or some crazy figure of lesbian books that are written and read are romances. There's this assumption that if you write a book starring a lesbian, it's going to be a romance. And then people, yeah, you know, then they read it and they say, oh, but she doesn't get the girl. Well, you know, yes, she does, but not in the way that you want.
Mm-hmm.
But my mainstream readers, of course, you know, real crime fiction lovers, or even, you know, women lesbians who are crime fiction readers and not necessarily just lesbian fiction romance readers, crime fiction readers have no problem with it at all.
Yeah. I am going to get on my soapbox a little bit here. You know, male tends to refer to a gay romance of some kind. And I go on to Goodreads and I see people shelving my books as male, and it drives me crazy because it is not in my head male in any way.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a little romance, but that's it.
Yeah.
You know? So that's why I was curious is if you did get any blowback as a result of that. And I will say Anthony Bedulka was on, I think it was last month. Yes, it was last month. And he did say one very good thing, a very interesting thing that I think has some validity. And he said, those that really push for our characters to have a romance, he said, if people are reading, if they've read books 1 through 5 and now we're going to buy number 6, it means they like Cantor.
Right.
And they want what is best for Cantor.
Right.
And to some people in their heads, that means settling down and having a love in their life.
Right. But that may not be what's best really for Cantor. We'll see.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I'm not arguing that at all.
Yeah.
I'm just saying he has a point that I think a lot of people think that is what is it. You know, we watch the movies. It's always that.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, it depends. Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether Cantor's going to settle down and fall in love. I have a sense of the arc of the series. But whether Cantor actually settles down with someone at this point, that's an open question for me. And it's not really going to be me who decides. It will be Cantor who decides.
Yeah. Well, I'm the same way with my character.
Of course, I
tell people I'm not guaranteeing anything.
Of course, you can't.
All I guarantee is at the end of every novel, the crime will be solved.
Beyond that, and that doesn't always mean that justice is served.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially in Cantor's world.
I tend to say justice could be served, but yeah, it may not always be
in
that.
In Cantor's world, justice and crime solving are not the same thing. There's a kind of rough justice, I suppose, that happens, but not always.
And I want to talk more about where you said when you worked for a private investigator and you became disillusioned with our criminal justice system. And you had mentioned that a lot of these people just, it's a whole different perspective than many people, that that is just the way life is. That is their survival.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you grew to understand that.
Yes.
That a lot of people don't get that.
Right.
Do you see that it's still the same?
Yes. Oh, I think that's, not only is it still the same, I think it's even spreading. Yes, I think it's still the same and possibly even spreading as life becomes tougher. But I also think it's also cultural. You know, people are born into situations, into a culture, into a neighborhood, into a way of life that has entirely different rules than the mainstream. Mm-hmm. That has its own codes, so to speak, and its own sense of financial opportunity, which we would label a crime, and for them, it's opportunity. So I think that's the same. Yeah, I think as times become tougher, it's possibly spreading. I mean, people are going to survive any way they can. People are going to survive any way they can.
Yeah, it goes back to, and I wish I could remember who said it. Some would probably tell me it's in the Bible, but the old saying, if a man steals a loaf of bread to feed a starving family, is he a criminal? And should he be punished? You know, and that's the perspective I think they're viewing from.
Yeah.
This is survival.
It's exactly right. It's survival. And I saw a lot of that when I was working for the private investigations firm, is people who looked at these things from an entirely different telescope. It's like we look through the telescope through the small eyepiece and they look through the telescope from the other end.
Yes, exactly. Are you familiar with the podcast Ear Hustle?
No, I'm not. Tell me about it.
You need to listen to it. I think you would love it, especially the very earliest ones. They kind of branched off into some other things now. It comes out of San Quentin Prison.
Oh, my.
And there is a woman that is a volunteer in their audiovisual department. And one of the inmates is there and they co-host this show and they don't glamorize prison life. It's not whining about prison life. It's just, this is what prison life is like. And it's one of three, I think I subscribed over 24 podcasts, but there's only three that I auto download every week. And that is one of them.
I'll check it out.
And what I love about it is, you're listening to these interviews, and they interview some of the inmates multiple times, and you're listening to them, and they're charismatic, and you really get to know them. And then you have to stop and say to yourself, wait a minute, he killed three people.
Right.
And you realize, for better or worse, these are human beings.
Right. They're human beings. You know, I mean, there's crime and there's crime. It's like the fellow you brought up, if he steals a loaf of bread to feed his family, is he a criminal? That's one kind of criminal. Then there's greed. And then there's we were talking about, opportunity. Now, there are evil people in the world, you know, people who are just off the deep end, like the Ted Bundys and all of that. But you know, that's in a category all by itself. That's something else. But I learned that there's so many different definitions of criminality that when I write a character who is herself a criminal, as an author, I have to walk that fine line of not condoning her, but not condemning her. And mm-hmm. I hope I've succeeded. I would leave that to you and my readers. But it is a fine line.
And I'm going to give you my personal opinion, and I'm trying to think how to word it. You don't glorify the crime. But it is enticing because not because I want to rob anything, but her life is exciting.
Yes, it is.
So, you know, I'll never act on it, but yeah, it's kind of cool what she does.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I will say maybe you glorify, but not really, you know. I hope I'm making sense there. You're not encouraging people to go out.
No, not at all. You know, and I think I make that clear in that her life is dangerous. You don't want to do it. And I think a lot of the reason why people don't do crime is two reasons. I mean, I don't murder anybody because the thought, I can't. I mean, that's just so wrong. The thought would make me ill. I couldn't live with myself to kill somebody. Could I steal something? There's a different question. I won't, and most of us won't. But I'm not sure it has anything to do with right and wrong. Though it does. You know, I won't, stealing from someone who has less than you, stealing, you know, yes, it's right, it's wrong. But I think most of us don't steal because we're afraid we can't get away with it. We're afraid of getting caught.
And I'm going to tell on myself here. I don't know. I think it was junior high. And a lot of kids do this. I shoplifted. I was at a department store. And it was stuff I didn't even want.
Right.
Had no need for. But there was that thrill.
Right.
And of course, I got caught and you know, dealt with the repercussions and whatever. And rightfully so. But there's definitely a thrill in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
That's undeniable. So just don't act on it. Any kids listening out there, don't act on it.
Well, let me ask you this.
It was a pain in the
let
butt.
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
You got caught, and that put the fear of God into you, and you never did it again, because getting caught had ramifications, and it was a pain in the ass, and it was probably scary, and your parents were mad, and all of that kind of thing. But what if you hadn't gotten caught? Would you have been tempted to do it again?
That's a really hard question to answer. It's a hard question to answer. And I will say, having never done it again wasn't because of the fear of my parents, their actions, or even the actions of the police or the security guard of the store. I didn't want to do it again because I got caught and it wasn't fun anymore.
But what if you hadn't gotten
so,
caught?
Yeah, so would I have done again? I think there's a good chance I would have.
If the only thing you had was the thrill and not the downside, would have done it again.
I mean, we have to ask, why was Winona Ryder shoplifting?
Right, yeah.
You know, I used to work right around the corner from the store that she got arrested in.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm sure her and her doctor may have an answer to that, but I sure don't know. I'm sure it had to do with the thrill.
Could be, yeah. I don't know why most people do anything. Who knows? But speaking for Cantor, I know why she leads the life she leads. And it's because she feels she has no other choice. You know, the law is going to treat her as a criminal just for breathing, you know, just for her love of women, which is a very flimsy reason to put somebody in jail. So she likes to, as she says, she pokes her finger in the law's eye. So she's a criminal because she feels the world has given her that, you know, in order to keep her integrity, that's the only option. Because if she lives a law-abiding life, then she would be living dishonestly.
So now it's time for awkward questions authors get.
Okay.
And you know the deal. You did it before. I'm going to spin the wheel and you're going to get a question. I want people to know, I do really choose these questions at random. And what I did, I sent out emails to 2 or 3 dozen authors. I think it was close to 3 dozen authors. And I said, what are some kooky questions that you got? And those are what I have in the bowl that I draw from at random. But I thought about Anne and I thought, I am pretty sure she is one of those people that answered my question for me. And I think I liked it. So I did a search. And so your question is not random. I found one of the questions that you sent me.
Oh my goodness.
And it is actually one of my favorite.
Oh my.
And that's the one you're going to get today.
Oh gosh.
So here you go. Do you write sex scenes from experience or is it all from your imagination?
Well, both. In all honesty, both. Both. It's right, what I have experienced and what I'd like to experience. So it's both.
Would you say Cantor's sexual experiences or whatever change in each book? And is there a reason why?
That's a good question. It's not so much whether they change because of anything she is or how she may have changed. they change because she always makes love in a way that's in response to the woman she's with. So no two women are alike. So first of all, I don't write lengthy sex scenes. As you notice, sometimes they're a paragraph or two at most. And they're not about the sex at all. They are about the emotions experienced during the sex, the passion experienced during the sex. And that is never the same from one woman to another. So the changes in the sex scenes have nothing to do with how she's changed as much as her response to whom she's with.
The reason I asked you that second part of the question is, this whole question of sex in mysteries comes up quite a bit. And I was talking to Michael Nava one day about
good
it,
old Michael.
And he said to me that the reason to have, you don't necessarily always have to have a sex scene in a novel, but he said one of the good reasons to is the way a person has sex.
That's exactly right.
Tells you a lot about the individual.
It does. Yes.
And you just said the same thing, really.
That's exactly right. And I'm not surprised that Michael would say something like that. Michael is a brilliant writer, one of my favorite all time. But it's that. But I think you and Michael, too, would also agree with me that not only does it tell you a lot about the people, the character. For me, a sex scene has to tell you about the character of Cantor and the woman that she's with. And it has to advance the story. Something in the emotional experience of that sex scene, of that sexual encounter, has to advance the story. If it doesn't, it's just a gratuitous sex scene, no matter how much it tells you about the character. It must plug into the story somewhere.
Yeah, and I wish I could remember who it was. She identifies as lesbian, and she was talking about a lesbian novel she was reading, and she said she got really into the mystery, and all of a sudden there was a sex scene. And then the sex scene ended and went right back to the mystery. And she said, what the hell was that about? You know, that's what you're talking about. Don't just shove it in there for no reason to titillate.
Yeah.
That's not what I read a mystery
right.
for.
Right.
If I wanted that, I'll get an erotic novel, right. which is A-okay.
Right. And Cantor's, the sex scenes in all the Cantor books accomplish just what we've been talking about. They tell you about her. They tell you about the other woman. They tell you about the situation, and they advance the story. It has to have all of that, or it's just gratuitous, and it has no place in the story.
I agree with you, and I will tell you, you do it well.
Well, thank you so much. So,
I am so glad I had you back again.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. It's always wonderful to talk to you, Brad.
It was an absolute pleasure. So thank you again. And oh, I guess I should remind people of the book. It's Hunting Gold. And it is number 6 in the Cantor Gold series.
But it can be read as a standalone. I think people should know this. All the books can be read.
Thank you, because...
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to read...
Anybody that listens to this show knows that is a big deal for me. Yeah. I want a series novel to stand alone.
Yeah, I mean,
so very
it's
good.
Very nice if people want to read all the books, but you can read any one of them, including Hunting Gold, as a standalone. Absolutely.
Okay, so here's the deal. If you like reading books in a series... And we'll have no complaints if you go to Amazon right now and order all 6 books.
I will not have any complaints.
But if you just want to go to this novel, and I will tell you, it's a great standalone, go ahead and order this one as well. But it is available right now as this is released. It is available for pre-order and soon to be released. So if you're listening to this show, it's available to order. So get the book.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Thank you again, Anne.
Thank you, Brad.